And welcome to episode number 25, big 25 of the Functional Nerds. This is, I haven't told John yet, but this is going to be the mega triple size 25th episode a la Marvel style in 3D.
Oh, how are we getting it in 3D?
I don't know yet.
Yeah,
I haven't figured that part out. Anyway, I'm Patrick Hester. I'm a author, a blogger, and all-around functional nerd. And my partner in crime in this is Mr. John Anelio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy and other nerdy things. You can get a lot of my music for absolutely free if you want, or pay what you want, over at johnanelio.bandcamp.com. And you could follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/johnanelio.
Did you see my tweet?
I did. I enjoyed your Bandcamp tweets. It's a horribly named service for that. So I'm glad that you had the. But it's a great service nonetheless. But
and I think I just figured out how to do 3D. I told DiNardo, you know, Lucas is giving away his money to charities. So I was trying to get DiNardo to turn SF Signal into a 501c3.
Okay. Yeah.
So we just need to take the Functional Nerds, turn that into a 501c3, get like $1 billion from Lucas. Bam, we can do a 3D podcast.
All right. Sounds good. We'll get into the works on that.
We'll work on that for number 100.
Yes. Joining us tonight, a third nerd, is a author whose work I've been reading for the past year. And as I was telling him before the show, I kind of OD'd on a couple of his things over the past week. And that is Chris Robertson. Say hello, Chris.
Howdy, everybody.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Chris, much like our guest last week, Matt Sturgis, writes both novels and comics. One of his most recent comic works, is I guess we would call it From Fable Town with Love, Cinderella. And I just read that graphic novel, and it was quite good, and I hope everyone out there is familiar with it, and if not, go check it out. And Chris has written several novels at this point, several of them published through Pyre, and quite a few other publishers as well. And so we're just had Chris for a chat and today, and we wanted to talk a little bit about last week, Matt Sturgis told us about the writing group that you guys were a part of. You guys were college friends. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about, from your point of view, to see if your story matches up with Matt Sturgis's, or if his was a total lie.
Well, Matt was just this sad, hapless loser I took under my wing. And as I think Matt mentioned in his interview, that like he'd given up on geek stuff when he was in high school, when he discovered girls. And clearly didn't understand that you can do both. And we met the first day of freshman orientation, and he liked my shoes. I had customized a pair of Chuck Taylors to make them look like the ones that Kevin Matchstick wore in Mage, the Matt Wagner comic. And he said, "Those are cool shoes." And I said, "Yeah, they're from a comic." And that began the now more than 20-year process of trying to bring Matt back over to the geek side.
Cool. Now, what college did you guys go to anyway, if you feel like divulging that?
I don't mind. I don't owe them money, so I can say. We both attended the University of Texas at Austin, and we were part of the hoity-toity liberal arts art honors program there. We actually got to study comics in a couple of our classes, which was cool, and science fiction novels as well.
Are you familiar with Austin City Press?
The name is familiar.
It's the food truck.
Okay, yeah.
I'm obsessed with the great food truck race on Food Network. And one of the food trucks was the Austin City Press.
Okay.
You have to find them, you have to try their sandwiches, and you have to tell me if they're any good.
I'll take that under advisement.
Okay, cool.
So you guys met in college and were friends, and then Matt talked a little bit about the writing group that you guys were a part of. How long after college was that, or was that during college, the writing group that you guys were part of?
It was long after. Well, I say long. It wasn't that long now that we're old. We graduated in 92. We were roommates together for a while in San Francisco in our 20s, and then the writing group started in, I want to say, the beginning of 98. So we were... You know, 27, 28 by that point. So it was a few years on. We felt like we were very mature by that point. But yeah, pretty much as Matt said, though, he always he gets it wrong a little. I knew Mark Finn from the comic shop, and then met Bill and then said...
But which Bill are you talking about? I know who you're talking about.
This is Bill Willingham. Yeah. Sure. Bill Willingham was starting up a writing group, and I said, I know this guy from college who just moved to town. He wants to be a rock star, but he really needs to be a writer. You know, he should join the gang. And on my say-so, they let him join the gang. And he was awesome.
So you're like Paul bringing George to John.
Yeah, yeah, you can go with that.
Now, you know, before we get into all the writing stuff, I'm really curious now because, you know, obviously I do music, and, you know, Matt had mentioned that he wanted to be a rock star first. And I know through some of the things that you talk about in your fiction and also following you on Twitter, you're obviously a big music fan. Can you talk a little bit about like sort of your involvement in music or maybe Matt's? I mean, have you guys played in bands? Have you, you know, how into it are you? I'm curious.
Matt did for years. I mean, Matt was in a few bands in college. And then when we were in San Francisco in our 20s, he did a number of like kind of solo acoustic shows at little hole-in-the-wall venues in San Francisco. I was never cool enough to be in bands. I made the mistake in high school of learning the trumpet. And since I had not yet discovered ska, I didn't realize that that was something you could do that would be cool. And so by the time I got into college, when all my friends were in bands, I just, you know, I never learned to skateboard either. So I've always just been an admirer from the sidelines.
Yeah. Keep going. I'm sorry if you had anything else to say about that before I cut you off.
No, go ahead. Cut me off.
You know, you should have combined the two. You should have tried skateboarding and playing the trumpet at the same time. Everybody would have thought you were the coolest kid in town.
I don't really need all these teeth. I like soft teeth.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm very curious. Now, does Sturgis still do music at all, or is it more of just kind of in the background for him now?
I know that he occasionally plays his guitar, but I don't know that he's done it with anyone in earshot in mm-hmm. several years.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, if he does, you know, he's got a venue here because we do a lot of music stuff here. So if he ever gets around to like, you know, writing some songs or something, wants to unleash them on the world, we would be happy to play them on our podcast here. I think that would be pretty awesome.
He threatens to write a musical every couple of years.
Cool. any sort of fantasy or sci-fi kind of elements to the musical, or just a straight up musical about something else?
Now, the musicals were normally, I think he was going to do, he and Willingham had talked for years about doing something Fables related. And then Matt for years has been talking about doing, and I don't think it's musical. This would be a spoken word thing. He wanted to do a one-man show of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And I don't know why he hasn't done it yet, because I think it would be fantastic.
I think he hasn't done it because Shatner taught us all that you shouldn't.
That's not true.
Did you see, I think it was about a week ago, that there's like a Klingon opera. Yeah. Did you guys hear about, see that online?
Yeah,
is it that? Someone actually wrote out a whole opera in Klingon.
In the Netherlands or something?
Yeah.
Because I have no secret shames, I will admit that I was once a card-carrying member of the Klingon Language Institute.
Awesome. Well, I think you just earned your nerd cred right there. Like, if you didn't already, you got it there.
I refused to join Starfleet, but I did join the Romulan Empire when I was like 18, and I was in it for like a year and a half.
You could do both. Just be a double agent.
Well, I joined, and then I went to a party because I just wanted to hang out with people. And I show up at this party, and all these people are in costume, and I just kind of got a little weirded out.
I got that.
Now, with Willingham and Sturgis, they were looking to write like a Fables based musical. Is that still on the table, or is that sort of pushed off to the side at this point?
You know, I don't know. It's dim recollections, and I have to confess that usually when they're talking about it, I've had a few drinks, so I don't remember.
Musicals are always something that people, if they ever talk about doing it, it's always over a few drinks, because I've been involved in, I wrote the music for a musical that never really saw the light of day. I had a drummer friend who had this whole lyrical concept, and he's like, you just need to help me with the music. I have all the lyrics and stuff. And it was called Au Pair, the musical, because where I live in New Jersey, there's a ton of like German and English and Australian au pairs here that, you know, are like nannies and stuff. So he had dated like five or six of them over the stretch of a year, had this whole storyline about au pairs. And I must have wrote like seven or eight songs with them for this stupid thing that ever saw the light of day. Because it sounds so great, a musical. It's like it's this big, you know, creative undertaking. And then it's like, well, how are we ever going to put this on? It's like,
yeah, such what are we going to do with this? Yeah.
What are we going to do with this? It's not like we can go to a coffee shop and perform this or anything. It's like we got to get a ton of money to put it up. So, but that's interesting. I'd love to hear more about that. We'll have to have Sturgis on again and have to tell us all about that. But let's talk about you.
All right.
And so, comic books and novels. And I don't want to get to monkey brain.
Yeah.
I do those things.
Yeah. Now, what did you get? Did you kind of make a name writing comics first or novels first?
Well, I became a novelist by default. All I wanted to do since I was 8 was write comics, but I couldn't figure out how to break in.
It's rough. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people.
It's really difficult. And it turns out that it's, even though far fewer people read science fiction novels and short stories than read comics, which is itself kind of a scary factoid, it's easier to sell a short story or a novel than it is to break into comics.
Wow.
And it typically is because, without going into too much detail, writing is one of those pursuits where the better you get at it, the harder it is and the longer it takes. And also it pays really poorly. And so short fiction prose markets are always hungry for new writers because they pay peanuts and the work gets progressively harder. And so once they've kind of built a name for someone by publishing them in Asimov's or FNSF or wherever, it's harder and harder to get them to keep coming back. And so they're constantly scouting the slush pile for new people. So after, you know, a decade plus of trying to break into comics and failing, I started seriously trying to break into novels and short stories and eventually succeeded. And, you know, the grand prize was the peanuts they paid me. yay me. So I did eventually, I think, 13 novels and about 36 short stories or so that got published. And I guess you could say I had a name. I had a readership in the hundreds. And then eventually, thanks to Willingham opening the door, was able, on the strength of that, to get into comics. Whereas I wanted to be from the beginning. So I'm still doing both, but I'm super, super happy to be doing comics.
Well, and Vertigo is a step up as far as I'm concerned from
It's definitely brass ring territory. Yeah. I was incredibly fortunate enough to come in at a very high level rather than most of the comics writers I know who have to kind of slave in the trenches. I was able to come in, you know, at a very kind of plum gig from the first job I did.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of we had Peter V. Brett on the podcast a couple months ago, and he is a big comics fan himself, but sort of became a New York Times bestselling fantasy novelist first, and now he's getting into writing comics now, which is where I think he's going to keep pumping out the novels too, but I know he's doing Red Sonja. Is that what he's doing, Patrick?
I think it was Red Sonja, yeah.
Yeah, so now he's going to be doing Red Sonja, which I don't think is out yet, but I know he was really psyched about doing the comics, you know, so it's kind of funny. You guys both have that same path of, and Sturgis, I guess, is sort of the opposite. He did comics first, but kind of thought of himself more as a prose writer. So you just kind of go about it the way that you do.
Yeah.
Now, so I was reading in the back of Here, There, and Everywhere about, you know, with the writing group that you guys started, and you guys were doing this where you'd write essentially a novel in a weekend in like a 72-hour period.
I did that once. It was terrible.
It's
the first one I did was pretty bad.
Now, were you published before that? Is this all before you ever got published, that kind of 72-hour writing novels thing?
Yeah, basically. So all four of us, Willingham, Sturgis, Mark Finn, and I did the Clockwork Storybook site and then our self-published endeavors for several years before any of us but Willingham really had a professional credit. Willingham had been kicked out of comics, as happens periodically for him. He's just a people person. And so, yeah, all that stuff was done. It was great. It's one of those things, you know, to use a music example. When the Beatles went to Hamburg and just played, was it in the Ratskeller? They played in this kind of dive.
I think it was the Cavern. I think they might have played the Ratskeller too.
The Cavern was the one in
Liverpool. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. You're right.
So they started playing it. They started playing in Liverpool. Didn't really have much of a following. Somebody was hiring up bands at this dive / strip club in Germany, and they went to play there. And they played constantly to very small audiences for a couple of years.
But they got really good.
Exactly. So that when they went back to Liverpool and anyone was paying attention, they were fantastic. And that's what I really think that the Clockwork Storybook Experience was like. I know for me and Matt, and I think for Mark as well, because we were just cranking out stories every month at least. And in some cases, you know, novellas and novels in very short order that a very small number of people saw. But we got to kind of flush through the million words of crap that every writer has in them before they do anything good. So that as soon as anyone started paying attention, you know, we were not crap anymore.
Yeah, it's very much in line with, I think we talked about it with John Sprunk on the SF Signal podcast about, you're probably familiar with the Malcolm Gladwell Outliers book.
Yeah.
And he talks all about the what is it, 10,000 hours that it takes to get good at something. You know, he goes through like Bill Gates and Michael Jordan, and he mentions the Beatles in that chapter too about how, you know, talent is one thing, but really the people who are at the top of any of their field, it almost always comes down to raw hours put into your craft. And you just have to get good at it and you have to work on it. A songwriter friend of mine said the same thing about writing songs. He said, you probably need to write about 100 songs before you start writing anything decent. You know, you have to write about 100 crappy songs first. And through the process of writing those 100 crappy songs, yeah, you'll probably start writing some good ones after that. And it's just plug away, plug away, plug away, and just keep writing. And I think, you know, another, you know, from a musical point of view, as you said, I think a lot of people do an open mics and things like that. It's just, you just have to do it. You can't be afraid of making crap. I think that's what it comes down to. You have to sort of make your crap, and then eventually, if you're really dedicated and really want to do it, eventually you would hope to learn something through doing it and get pretty decent at it.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, doing the 100 songs, the million words, doesn't mean you'll be good, but you can't be good without doing it.
I think that's an excellent point. I think that's a point well taken.
You could still suck at the end of it, but
yes.
I still remember Greg Allman, one of the concert CDs that I have or something, he plays a song and he says, now I'm going to play for you the first song I ever wrote. And he strums a couple times. He says, well, I mean, the first song I ever wrote and kept.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right, because I think a lot of people, you know, probably keep at it but maybe aren't great. But you'll at least be better than you were than at the beginning, maybe. Hopefully. Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah. So, you know, you one of the things that I wanted to ask you about within your novels, as I said before we started the show, I just read Here, There, and Everywhere over the past couple of days, and I had read End of the Century.
It feels like a very Beatles-esque kind of podcast tonight.
Yes, it's a very Beatles-heavy podcast.
Beatles, Hamburg, Here, There, and Everywhere.
Yeah. And obviously Here, There, and Everywhere, he makes reference to the Beatles, and there's a little Beatles going on in the book as well. But I want to talk a little bit about the Bonaventure family that appears in this book, and obviously I read End of the Century about a year ago, and I kind of want to go back and read that now because there are some similar characters between the two. And what's, you know, your thoughts on that family and having them as characters that appear in at least these two novels? And from what I read in the appendix of Here, There, and Everywhere, it seems like they make appearances in quite a lot of your work.
They're in more than half of my novels and short, definitely more than half of my novels, a number of my short stories, and those are my favorite of the prose works I've done. The thinking was, let's see, there's a very long answer, and I'll try to give one that won't put everybody to sleep. I was inspired by a couple of different things, most notably like Philip Jose Farmer's Wald Newton stories, which posited that all the characters that Philip Jose Farmer had grown up reading and loving were really part of this big extended family tree. So Farmer had, you know, Tarzan and Doc Savage and Sherlock Holmes and all these guys on one big family tree. So, you know, cutting my teeth on that as a kid, when I started doing stuff in my mid to late 20s, I liked the idea of having a big structure I could fit a bunch of different kinds of stories into. And the Bonaventure Carmody family, there's actually two families that interconnect, seemed a handy way of doing that, because then I could have very different types of stories in terms of genre that had connections between them because characters were related or characters could show up in different books. And yeah, it's just like a fun intellectual exercise for me, but it's also a cool way of adding additional layers so that people that read it, like, for example, Into the Century or Here, There, and Everywhere or Set the Season on Fire or Paragia, which are the four big, I think that's all four of them. There might be another one I'm forgetting. But those are the four major Bonaventure novels. They're all entry-level books. They're all standalone books. But anybody that reads a second one suddenly begins to see connections to the others that add additional added meaning. And I'm just a big geek, basically. So it's fun to play off.
Have you ever? I just have one question, real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever read any of the Anne Rice vampire novels?
I went through a very huge and fervent Anne Rice phase right after The Vampire Lestat came out.
Mm-hmm.
So when, I guess it was Queen of the Damned was the third, am I remembering correctly?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was, you know, this was before the internet and I was in college. So I went to a Walden Books, I think like once a week for a couple of months. Like, do you have it yet?
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I think that's probably an unconscious influence as well. Cause each of those books, at least the first three or four.
Well, and if you get into the other books like The Mayfair Witches, there are characters who kind of go from book to book, like the Watchers that are out there. I forget the names. One of the girls ends up becoming a vampire, but she works for the family, the Watchers or something. Anyway, you know, those characters kind of are sprinkled throughout those books as well. And not quite in the same way as you're talking about. But it's a little bit, and so I was just curious if that might have been a bit of an influence on you.
You know, I hadn't thought of it like that way before, but considering the amount of time I spent thinking about those books in my teenage years, I'd be surprised if it wasn't an influence.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and just talking about what you mentioned, how your novels are standalone, and you're just, you know, you are using some of the you know, the Bonaventure family. That's exactly what happened to me. I remember reading End of the Century. Which is that your most recent novel, or have you had anything out since End of the Century?
There's another one that's not out in the States yet. I think it's supposed to come out in a couple of months, but okay. It was actually written before that. So that's the most recent one I've written and have had published. Yeah.
Okay. So and
Book of Secrets.
Sorry. No, End of the Century is the most recent one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Book of Secrets is one I wrote before that's coming out in a couple of months.
Gotcha.
Cool. So I read End of the Century about a year ago, and I really liked that book. It's so many different things going on, and one of the things that I like about both of the books that I've read is that there are these, I want to say, you know, somewhat intellectual, you know, concepts going on with, you know, the physics and the time travel and all that kind of stuff that's in it. I mean, it's, for me at least anyway, it's pretty intellectual stuff. And but that is really sort of plays as a supporting role to the characters. And that's not always the case when you have science fiction. A lot of times when you have something that's really, you know, in capital letters, science fiction, it's sort of the scientific concept that is really the most present thing in it. And I think it's secondary to the characters, because I found myself really caring about the characters pretty much right away. And I liked that about End of the Century. And I, there's a member of the Bonaventure family that is in End of the Century a little bit, as well as Sanford Blake, who we'll get into. But when I started reading, and I didn't intend on reading Here, There, and Everywhere before this interview, but I took it out of the library, as I'll often do before we have an author on the show. I'll take a couple things out of the library just to kind of have them, maybe look through them. And I just, as soon as I like kind of read the first page and realized that it was, you know, a similar character, the same character, I should say, as End of the Century, I just tore right through it because I really cared about them from the other book. And then it actually grows much deeper in reading Here, There, and Everywhere. But I think you're right. You can read both, all I'm guessing all, but just in the two that I read, they're totally standalone novels. But now I feel really hooked into this world, and now I really want to go check out the other novels to see how they build upon it. But I really wanted to compliment you on your character development and making the reader, at least in my case, really care about the character.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's the master plan. The master plan is a trick. But yeah, I mean, certainly the characters are where I start and end. And I like the big science ideas because I'm a big science nerd. But I wanted the books to work for people for whom the big science ideas were just set dressing. So you can kind of blaze through those books and kind of read past all the science and understand why it matters to the characters, but not get much more invested than that. Or as you're reading through, then suddenly there's some big science idea. And I treat the kind of the historical and the mythological stuff in the same way, where there's some of that stuff in there that I you know, anguished over for months, and it's a paragraph or two that if you want to pay attention to it, you can. And if you just want to find out, you know, who ends up with who, you can just keep going.
But I think that really adds to the richness of the novels. Is like you said, you know, when you're in a certain time period, and it, you know, it feels very, I mean, I know nothing about those time periods myself, but it feels accurate to me, or it feels authentic, at least, I guess it would be a better way of putting it. And I think it adds to all these different layers. And that's the thing. There's all of these layers going on in the books, but because the characters are so strong, and because I don't think, you know, I don't think you ever lose sight of the character story, all of that other stuff just sort of adds to it. And it doesn't, like you said, you can focus as a reader, you could focus on it if you want, but it doesn't ever take away from the main character story.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, was there a question in there, John? Or?
No, I'm sorry. I like your books.
Too. Yeah.
I believe John is having a fanboy moment.
Well, I just like, you know, I wouldn't look. I have a full time job. I have the music stuff that I do. Like I'm not a professional reviewer. I read these books because I like them, and I'm not going to read something if I'm hating it. You know. So, but you know, I really like Chris's books. I think the music thing was certainly, or just sort of a lot of like sort of the pop culture references and the music references. I mean, that certainly drew me in, and I think was what was you know, kind of hooked me in to want to read it in the first place. But it just combined a lot of the elements that I really like.
Those are both very musically focused books. I mean, Here, Then, Everywhere has the whole Beatles thing running through it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, End of the Century, you know, to me, it's like it's David Bowie, pretty much throughout. He shows up very briefly, but then again, there's the Ramones thing too with the quote in the title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk a little bit about your novels. I'm not your novels. Your comics work.
Before you do that,
okay.
Let's just throw out there. I mean, he does have the Bonaventure. Was it Carmody?
Carmody, but
Carmody.
You know, again, I'll answer to anything, and I'm sure they will too.
But you also have the Celestial Empire, which is intriguing to me because it's alternate history. And that, I mean, how did you come to decide to do an alternate history where China took over?
boy, we were talking before about things that happen over drinks. I ended up accidentally writing, I think, three novels, maybe four novels and something like a couple dozen short stories because of something I did over drinks. It was Lou Anders, who I believe you know.
Yes, yeah, we did.
When I first met him, it was at the World Fantasy Convention in October of 2001. And I was just one of the Clockwork Storybook guys and had no professional credits. But I can hold my liquor and I know a bunch of stuff. So I met Lou through our mutual friend, John Picasso, who's now multi-award-winning science fiction illustrator superstar.
Right.
And
we know John too.
John is great.
Yes. He's a daddy now.
He is.
Which is awesome.
I learned that right before everybody else did. So I felt a little bit special.
Cool.
I was at his wedding too. So. this is my total name dropping moment at John Picasso's wedding. At the reception, I sat next to Michael Moorcock.
Nice. You know, that I always think it's kind of cool when people drop names that way. Like when we talked to Mike Resnick.
That's it. It just drops. He likes dropping it. That's all.
I bought Mike Resnick lunch once. So
I think he wants us to buy him lunch too. I think that was how we got him on the show. I think he wants us to buy him lunch. But anyway, continue with John Picasso's wedding and Michael Moorcock.
So Lou was just queuing up what ended up becoming his first kind of wide release anthology, Live Without a Net. And I think he took pity on Sturgis and I by allowing us to kind of blind submit stories that he would consider maybe rejecting. And so both of us, you know, we were on the same plane back with my wife, Allison Baker, who's the co-owner of Monkey Brain. And I basically wrote the story for his anthology in my head on the flight back and typed it up as soon as I got home and mailed it off. And all I knew about China at that point was what I'd learned from Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor. Mm-hmm. And so I just wrote this story with basically no basis in history except that movie. And Lou bought it. It was published, and then it was nominated for, the World Fantasy Award for short story and for the Sidewise Award for alternate history short form. It lost the World Fantasy, thank God, but it won the Sidewise Award. And so we were at a con about a year and a half later, and Lou asked me what happened next, what happened after that story. And I was like, well, they go to Mars, obviously, and there's Aztecs there, and they fight them. And so he said, you have to write that. So I wrote that, and then other people started asking me for more, and then people started asking me for novels. And when it was said and done, I'd written this kind of alternate history / future history of this Chinese-dominated Earth that covered something insane like 10,000 years, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was the thing I did.
Very cool. Very cool.
Awesome.
That has to be, I'm just thinking difficult, you know, as far as keeping an alternate timeline straight in your own head.
I have a lot of research materials and a very, very detailed wiki database I built for myself.
Very cool. Yeah, I know someone else who did that. That's awesome. Okay, John, now you can talk about comic books.
Oh, well, I just wanted to, I just read Cinderella from Fabletown with love. And, I haven't been reading comics really at all in the past 10 years, a little bit here and there, a couple graphic novels. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your work on Cinderella? And I also know that you're doing iZombie now as well. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the comic stuff that you're working on right now.
Well, sure. As I said, I tried to break into comics forever and failed. And then finally, Bill Willingham, Clockwork Storybook guy, who's now the Bill Willingham who writes Fables, which is one of the certainly most critically acclaimed and commercially successful creator-owned comics the last few years. He asked me to do a fill-in issue on Jack of Fables, which was the spinoff he was writing with Sturgis. And he and the editor liked that, and so they asked me if I would do a spin-off miniseries featuring the version of Cinderella from the Fables world. And Fables being a world where fairy tale characters are real and have fled to our world to hide out while a nasty war goes on in the fairy tale world. Cinderella has naturally become a super spy over the course of the last couple of centuries. So her cover is that she is a ditzy blonde who runs a shoe store in Manhattan. But secretly, in her jet-setting travels, she is a deadly secret agent who safeguards the lives of the other fairy tale characters. So Cinderella from Fabletown with Love was the first kind of long-form comic I did. And it's basically on Her Majesty's Secret Service meets Sex and the City. It's that character on a big adventure, but also with all these other things going on. She meets her opposite number from another community of fairy tale characters, the Arabian Nights fairies, fairy tale characters rather, Aladdin, and they have adventures. And there's lots of people getting kicked in the face. There's talking animals because it is Cinderella. But that was fairly well received. When that was done, I was desperate for more work and pitched about a million things to our editor at Vertigo, Shelley Bond. And finally, the thing that landed was the book I'm doing with her now called iZombie, which is drawn by Mike Allred of Madman fame. And it's about a zombie girl detective. It's essentially if Nancy Drew had to eat a brain once a month to keep her memory and personalities. She is a zombie who works at a graveyard, but she doesn't want to hurt anybody. So once a month, she digs up the freshest corpse and eats its brain. Because if she doesn't, she'll become a George Romero shambling mindless zombie. Her best friends are a ghost girl and a were-terrier. And the two rivals for her affection are a monster hunter who would have to kill her if he knew she was a monster, which he doesn't. And a sexy mummy guy who is trying to kind of lure her over to the dark side to become a true monster. And hilarity ensues. And in issue 6, which comes out next month, we finally, at long last, introduced the talking monkey, which has taken me, 6 issues to get to.
So two questions come to mind immediately. So Sean Connery tells the world he's done. He's never going to play James Bond again. George Lazenby gets the role. It's the worst Bond movie ever, and that's what you used to describe Cinderella. It's on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Well, I was referring to the novel.
Okay. Because Lazenby.
There are Lazenby apologists, though.
I know Lazenby.
There are people who would fight you on that claim.
Even he said it was terrible. I mean, he's like, man, this is never going to go anywhere. What have I gotten myself into? Dear agent, get me out of this contract. Then he went on to do, softcore porn for 20 years or something.
I think my favorite Bond might be Woody Allen.
Yes. From Casino Royale.
Yeah.
That's a great movie. Peter Sellers is in it. Woody Allen, there's a ton of – wasn't he Jimmy Bond? He just wanted to be
something like that. He's just the latest inheritor of the title James Bond. Yeah.
Yes, David Niven, Sir David Niven, I believe. The second question I was saying: have you seen Being Human? BBC series.
No. That's the BBC one. No, I'm always getting this mixed up. I've not. I'd heard about it. Was thinking about checking it out, and then everybody told me it was just like my idea. And so now I haven't. You confuse me with the Peter Sellers because I'm always confusing it with Being There, the Peter Sellers movie. And Every time someone asks me that question, I say, oh, yeah, the Peter Sellers movie? No. Nor the Robin Williams movie about his reincarnation thing.
I forget what that one's called.
Being Human.
Was it Being Human?
Yeah.
That was something else.
Honestly, it was just 6 months ago where I got the title Being Human. I was like, why does everyone keep using this title? And I finally figured it out. But no, I haven't now intentionally.
It's a ghost, a werewolf, and a vampire who are trying to be human.
Yeah. Ironically, there was an ad for Being Human on the back of at least the second or third issue of iZombie, which I realize now I'd never said the name of iZombie. So iZombie.
Yep. The channel formerly known as Sci-Fi is Americanizing Being Human and going to put it on probably after wrestling or something.
Okay. If I stick around through Piranha 3D, I can see it then.
Yes. Yes.
Now, Chris, we're getting near the end, but one of the things I think we definitely need to talk about, and we'll definitely have to have you on our show again and maybe have you over on the SF Signal podcast soon to talk more about all the different things that you have going on. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Monkey Brain books. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Monkey Brain is and does and what you have going on over there?
Monkey Brain is a giant act of hubris. Brain Books is an independent press, I think we call it now. It's a small press. It's a tiny press. I run it out of the corner of my office. It's a publishing company that I co-own with my wife, Allison. It was started out of the wreckage of the first incarnation of Clockwork Storybook, which has since reformed Phoenix-like from the ashes. But once I learned how to run a publishing company, I discovered I could run a publishing company. And there were a number of books that I wanted to own, I wanted to have on my shelf that didn't exist. And I figured, what the hell, I can do that. And so started a company to do it. And we have now done, I think, about 24 titles in the last 7-8 years, something like that. When we started, Monkey Brain was focused on nonfiction genre studies, which is a highfalutin way of saying books about geeky stuff. And as we've gone along, we've added genre fiction to the mix. So we do books about comics and science fiction and movies, but we also do novels and novellas, collections of short stories and things like that. We're small but wiry. We do anywhere from 1 to 3 titles a year. Our books look fantastic. They tend to sell out really fast because we're cheap and only print a few. And we're still doing it.
And you've got some great names. I mean, Lou Anders, Denny O'Neill. Who else did I see on here? Jose Farmer, Michael Moorcock.
Yep. We've done 3 companions to Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen that are written by Justin Evans. Justin Evans also wrote the Encyclopedia Fantastic Victoriana, which we could not print enough of to meet demand. So there's lots of angry people out there who want me to do more, but I can't afford it. Kim Newman is a fantastic British writer who is criminally not as well known as he should be in the United States. And we are about to do the 3rd collection with him, novellas by New York Times bestseller Sean Williams, Jay Lake, Hal Duncan. It's this kind of weird mix of comic and science fiction things that I like and therefore publish books about.
Any relationship whatsoever with the Drunken Monkey Brewery?
Not that I'm aware of, though I like monkeys and I have been known to have drink.
Nice. Well, as we're wrapping it up here, Chris, is there anything else you want to tell us about before we finish up the show?
I'm doing a bit more comics work these days. I'm just about to wrap up a 8-issue prequel to Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep for Boom Studios. And I'm about to do a ongoing superhero science fiction title with Boom called Starborn. It's being kind of project managed by Stan Lee. So I got to have breakfast with Stan Lee one day, which was fantastic.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. You also said you wanted to school us about superhero books.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Last, I can't believe we forgot that. Yeah.
You guys were talking about Mast, which is a great anthology, if only because I'm in it. No, and Willingham's story is fantastic. Mast, okay. The Willingham's story is great. I think one of you said, was it Patrick, that you know, there are not many or any great prose superhero stories that are not tie-ins?
I don't know if I said there aren't any great ones. I just said that there seems to be a lot of tie-ins. So, you know, you've got Final Crisis, you've got Nightfall, that kind of stuff.
Now you're backpedaling.
I honestly don't remember. That was a week ago, and I've slept since then.
I'll have to go back and check. Well, I mean, I'm not actually angry at you, but I just wanted to share with you the good news that is Austin Grossman's Suno Will Be Invincible. Do you know this book?
No.
No.
Austin Grossman is the writer. The title is Soon I Will Be Invincible. And it came out from Pantheon in the U.S. in 2007. Go to Amazon and buy a copy right now. It is fan-freaking-tastic. It is a straight-up superhero novel. There are two plot threads. One is about a new superhero starting out, and the other is a supervillain who is trying one last time to take over the world. And it is, I would say, maybe slightly tongue-in-cheek, but it is not a piss take. It is a very kind of sincere superhero universe filled with fantastic ideas. It's a great novel, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Cool. Very cool.
Awesome. Cool.
When you write, what kind of technology are you using? Are you a Mac? Are you a PC? Are you Word? What are you doing?
Yes, all of those. My desktop is a PC laptop. I write on Word when I'm on that. When I travel, I write on Pages on an iPad, and I just kind of move back and forth between the two.
I was just curious. Any upcoming conventions, appearances? Are you going to be at World Fantasy? Are you going to buy us a steak when we're there?
Sadly, I'm done for the year. This will be the first time in 10 years I've missed World Fantasy. But we just couldn't make it this year.
Figures. It's the first time in 10 years we're going and you're not going to be there.
I've been there every year since 2001. This will be the first one I've missed.
Bummer.
It's 2000. No, every year since 2000. That's I'm telling a lie. No, I'm
oh, done. Now you're backpedaling.
I am, but right away. I didn't wait a week. I did it right away. Now I'm pretty much done for the year until next year.
Okay.
Great. Well, why don't you throw out your website there and your Twitter handle and all that kind of stuff?
Yep.
My website is chrisroberson.net, chrisroberson. On Twitter, somebody else got Chris Roberson, so I am Chris_Roberson. And I tend to tweet more on the weekends when I've had a couple of drinks, but I try to make them always tasteful and germane.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're not following Chris Roberson, you should, especially if you like to have a few drinks and watch movies. He often on, quite a bit recently, but I think most weekends you will pick a movie, maybe not a great movie sometimes, or you know, a cult classic, let's say, or something kind of funny that maybe isn't supposed to be funny, and you'll come up with a hashtag, and you and several friends and other people who want to join in will start the movie at the same time whilst, you know, maybe partaking in an adult beverage and tweet your thoughts about it. And it is always very, very entertaining and hilarious. And I participated one time on, I believe the, Patrick, maybe you can guess this one from the hashtag, but Rum Away. That was my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. It usually involves rum in one form or another.
Yeah.
That's basically me and my wife, Allison, who is Allison type on Twitter. And then anybody we can dragoon in. If it's just the two of us, that's fine. We'll do it anyway. I think the most we've ever had at one time, we had probably 8 or 9 people once doing a movie at once. But yeah, it turns out that watching bad movies with drinks and the internet and Twitter is fantastic fun.
I've also seen people do that with like episodes of Doctor Who.
We just last week did an episode of Love Boat and Fantasy Island.
The old one or the new one?
Oh, the old one, yeah.
Okay.
It turned out that Fantasy Island was way more entertaining than Love Boat was, which was just not bad enough to be entertaining, but not good enough to be good.
I tell you what, I've found your tweets to be entertaining, and actually I've been finding Sam Sykes, who has Sam Sykes Swears, has been very entertaining lately. Brent Weeks has been entertaining lately. There's a lot of the younger authors. I don't want to say up and coming, because a lot of these guys have, you know, multiple books published and stuff, but they seem to be having a lot of fun with Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I see a lot of people who on Twitter will talk about what they had for breakfast or, you know, what they just picked up from the dry cleaners. And I tend not to go on Twitter unless I have something that I think is at least halfway amusing. And of course, my threshold for what I consider amusing drops after I've had a drink.
Well, so does everybody's.
Yeah,
exactly. And do we need to throw it out there that you also have monkeybrainbooks.com?
Monkeybrainbooks.com. That and chrisrobertson.net are linked generously back and forth to one another. But yeah, the books that we still have available are there for sale on monkeybrainbooks.com, and also information about upcoming titles.
Awesome.
Great. Sounds
John,
good.
John, you want to pimp your stuff?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You can, you know, I have my website, which is scifisongs.blogspot.com. You can get my album for as Pay What You Want over at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio. What do you got going on, Patrick?
Nothing. I got ATFMB. I don't think I've written any posts there in the last week and a half. But I did, you know, I wrote like two or three things for SF Signal that just made DiNardo happy. The teddy bear thing, I think, did you see that, Chris? The teddy bears at Borders?
No, I haven't. When did that go up?
About a week ago, week and a half ago, I guess.
Yeah. I guess Borders.
I was in the midst of deadline hell.
Borders has decided to put the Build-A-Bear kiosks.
Oh, right, the Build-A-Bear thing. I did see that, yeah.
And
yeah.
I ranted about it over at SF Signal. I also put up I'm sorry, go ahead.
I do remember that is what I'm saying.
Oh, and then I did a review of one of the Star Wars graphic novels. I'm not very prolific on the web this week, so I don't have a lot of stuff going on.
That's okay.
But Scott Seeley and his wife... did put up a Dragon Con recap for us over on functionalnerds.com that I thought was really good. So I wanted to pimp that out. Of course, you can follow me at Twitter, twitter.com/ATFMB. The blog is ATFMB.com. The Facebook is Facebook/ATFMB. I mean, I kind of got the all things for my brain going there. We have anything else going on, John?
Well, next week we're going to have Matthew Kressel and Kate Baker. Matt does Sybil's Garage, which is a short story collection, and so he's going to come and talk about that. I met him at ReaderCon, and I believe he's going to be at World Fantasy as well. So they're going to come and talk about that because Kate Baker has a story in there, and Kate also does a lot of work for Clark's World.
Yep.
And she was actually manning whatever, John Scalzi's blog. She was manning that while he was sort of away for about 6 weeks. So she's got a lot going on too. So Matt Kressel and Kate Baker next week.
That should be cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right. Well, I think that's the end of episode number 25. Coming up next, I'm going to play all of the 12 new songs that John Anilio has recorded specifically for this podcast.
If I only had the time.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris, for coming on. We really appreciate it. Well,
thank you, guys.
And I think we're done.
All right. See you next time, everybody.
Bye.
It's November. I'm going to write a novel in 30 days. And by December, take the end on the last page. I've got some music. I've got my shiny new laptop. And now I'll use it as I sit down at the coffee shop. But everybody thinks I'm crazy. But I've only got 1,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I thought that it'd be easy, but it's not. Yeah, I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I've got everything. Trusty sidekick. I've got a strong protagonist. There's a central conflict, but a weak antagonist. I've got a cliched setting.
just tried, but at least I'm getting some time to myself. I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I thought that it'd be easy, but it's not. Yeah, I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I've got everything I need. Decided to have Thanksgiving this time of year. Don't they know I'm trying to launch my writing career? But I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I thought that it'd be easy, but it's not. Yeah, I've only got 50,000 words to go.